We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined once again by my colleague, Christopher Bedford, senior editor at the Federalist, who I need to congratulate on his recent engagement to a good friend.
Thank you.
The one and only Sarah Westwood. Bedford, you celebrated in Ocean City.
Well, there's no class here. No more American, no more romantic place in this world than Ocean City, Maryland.
So, fun story for listeners. Chris was wise enough to gather some friends at a bar after the proposal, and it was an
Irish... She likes diamonds and she likes harp.
It was an Irish pub, and I'm looking around with another one of his fiance's friends, and we're like, we should, you know, while we're waiting, we should pre-order a bottle of champagne. And I was like, I don't know if they're going to have champagne at this Irish pub. We go up and ask the bartender, who I don't think has been more confused ever by a patron of his establishment in his life. He was so confused. And we did end up finding, I think we got the one cold bottle of champagne in the whole joint. But the backup was hilarious because our backup, I said, if you don't have champagne, just get two shots of Jack. And it turned out that as soon as you got there, you ordered shots anyway.
Well, the champagne's for the girls. Whiskey for the men.
Right, right. Well, Chris, congrats on that, first of all. And second of all, we want to get into, I think, some of the election type news that's swirling around, because as August comes to a close here in Washington, D.C., which is traditionally the deadest month in Washington, D.C. Country mile.
So far, August has been awful in D.C.
Well, yeah, but everyone's out of town.
I went on vacation and the FBI raided the president.
Yeah. Well, 100%. Congress is on recess in August, and that's when all the lobbyists take their vacations. Obviously, the FBI is not on vacation, but even Donald Trump himself, I believe, was in New Jersey at the time.
And one of the things that's ruined America is the invention of air conditioning. Hear me out.
No. I'm actually totally open to this. I'm completely open to this argument.
People stay in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And you couldn't. I mean, people's like Lincoln stayed during the Civil War. He went up to the highest point he possibly could and stayed in the house with all the windows open, like on a porch, fanning himself. But no, generally, people would just flee, and it was better that way.
It's a beautiful place, Lincoln's Cottage. If you're in D.C., it's one of the places nobody knows about. It gets so little
in a
traffic.
Strange neighborhood, like way off the beaten track.
It's beautiful, though. I highly recommend if you're looking for off-the-beaten-track stuff to do in Washington, D.C. But on that note, as August winds down, you start to see a lot of money go into races in the fall. And we are in a midterm election cycle. There are some really big races to look out for, and they're kind of developing right now. We're seeing the early stages of what is going to, I think, pan out in the fall in some of these races, like Oz versus Fetterman. We were talking a little bit about
what a weird race that is.
It's bizarre.
Oz versus Fetterman. It's like, could they both lose?
Honestly, it's okay. So this is what's interesting to me about that race, in that I think it is representative of problems that the Republicans are having, probably representative of problems that Democrats are having too. But on the Republican side, this is supposed to be, across the country, a really favorable landscape for the Republican Party. You have an unpopular president, a very, very unpopular president. You have incredible levels, historic levels of inflation. You have gas prices at a crazy high level. And you have all of this combining in a really bad economic the average American is in very bad economic condition right now, still dealing with supply chain crisis.
People are sick of it.
Exactly. But
COVID
even,
is no longer a cudgel. People are sexually kind of annoyed.
And people are still, but even in this like DC consultant way where they only talk about kitchen table issues, the kitchen table issues are terrible for Democrats right now.
Yeah.
People still can't find baby formula. And in Pennsylvania, you have a race that should be very winnable for Republicans. But Donald Trump endorsed Dr. Oz, I think, for some very obvious reasons. But one of the reasons—
Because he saw him on TV.
Well, he said Dr. Oz is the one who can win. And that's sort of what we've seen from behind the scenes. That's what the justification was for the Oz endorsement, despite the fact that he has a pretty, I'd say, dubiously conservative background. And the fact that he's just a, like, barely lives in Pennsylvania, questionably doesn't live in Pennsylvania. It seems like this could be a real swing and a miss. He's going up against, I think, one of the best candidates Democrats have fielded this cycle.
Well, at least best, I mean, yeah, because the guy looks like a tough guy. He's got that.
He's not, but yeah.
Yeah, he looks like he's got that, like, blue collar kind of tough guy, straight talking feel.
We ran
like a guy who looks like Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner. It's like it's the exact opposite. It's like, oh, this kind of Oz gives me the creeps through and through. But Fetterman's also, I mean, his story has gotten really creepy. The idea that he's never actually, like, this big, tough, like, straight talker has never actually held a job. He's literally paid for by his parents. He's like the Gen X equivalent of, like, living in his parents' basement with children. Imagine being a full-grown man who throws your chest around and your voice around like you're a big tough guy, wearing, like, a goatee with wife and kids who your parents pay for.
See, I don't think that's creepy.
That's so demasculating and weird.
Well, it might be a little weird. I think what he was doing, this is honest to goodness a knock on him in terms of especially the way you're leading voters to think you're someone who understands these kitchen table issues really well, perhaps from personal experience. He has been getting tons and tons and tons of money on a yearly basis from his parents who have basically supported his life where he's
it's like finding out that a biker gang watches My Little Pony.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, they probably do.
But he was doing, like, he was doing work in the community. He was doing charity work. He did go to Harvard. So in some ways...
A lot of losers went to Harvard.
Yeah,
and
that's
their
what I'm saying. Well, yeah, I wasn't saying Harvard is a good thing. Saying it as any, if anything, it's another thing. It's like a Pete Buttigieg situation. But the point here is that Oz is interesting to me because he's an example of how Republicans struggled this cycle, and I think understandably so, to decide what a good candidate is, right? Is a good candidate, because both the McConnell and the Trump camps are going to be unhappy with this slate, because on the McConnell side, you're going to be so annoyed that you have people like Herschel Walker. And on the Trump side, you're annoyed that there's still some establishment figures who are up for election in different places. But it's interesting because it's like, what is a good candidate in the post-Trump Republican Party? Is it somebody who can win? Like Dr. Oz? Is it somebody who's a professional football player who's never been in politics and has a spotty record but says the right things like Herschel Walker? I'm not saying any of that stuff necessarily in a pejorative sense. I'm saying it honest to goodness. The Republican Party didn't figure out this cycle. It would have been really hard to do.
It's an identity crisis.
Yeah, exactly.
And while
exactly.
We were focused on people like Liz Cheney, the loudest mouths in the room, and the reality is, like, Liz Cheney is not nearly as powerful as Mitch McConnell in deciding what the shape of this party is,
yep,
despite her best efforts. Mitch McConnell, as we've talked about in this podcast before, wants to make this not a culture war issue. It's so stupid. It's so mid-witted. Mm-hmm. It's insane. I saw an analyst on Fox News the other day saying, well, this candidate, that candidate threatens to lose independent women in this. It's like, it's a freaking midterm election.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? This is a base election. This is insane. The same problems don't affect you. And McConnell's doing the exact same thing, going after that. And he's pouring all of his money into candidates that are just part of what he wants, which is the low tax, more war, don't rock the boat, don't fight the culture.
Pick on China.
You can saber rattle all day about Taiwan, which means, like, nothing to America. But if you do anything about how we're actually being undermined in trade and currency and being spied on, if you do anything that's actually serious, then you're in trouble.
Well, I'm sure he's not happy with he wouldn't have picked Blake Masters or J.D. Vance, who I think are actually both pretty strong general election candidates in the primary. That would not be pleasing to Mitch McConnell.
Mm-hmm. No, he wouldn't. I mean, they're both great candidates. I don't know. J.D. Vance's campaign manager is, like, not doing a great job right now. But they're both very strong candidates that McConnell would never have wanted. And both those candidates, as well as a slate of others, are really signs that despite what McConnell's wanted and despite what he thinks is a perfect candidate, the party, the voters are actually deciding that they want a different direction for the GOP.
This just happened in the Wisconsin gubernatorial primary, by the way, where you had Rebecca Clayfish, who I don't have any problem with Rebecca Clayfish. But you had this situation where the Republican Party clearly, and the Republican Party of Wisconsin clearly had a dog in the fight, clearly wanted one person to win, and the voters made another decision and went with a more, I mean, some people would say Trumpy candidate, but that gets to the question, like, what is a Trumpy candidate in 2022? What is the better litmus test? Because support for Donald Trump clearly isn't in and of itself a litmus test. That's how you end up with, say, Dr. Oz, somebody who has a spotty record, but is going to express total fealty to Donald Trump because he knows and he's willing to do that to get elected. And so it is this, like, you're right. It's the Republican and Democratic Party are both having somewhat of an identity crisis right now. You see that in John Fetterman, the super wealthy guy who walks around with a goatee and Carhartt. So absolutely.
He's such a poser. I knew guys like that, like, all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
There were always guys like that who were just talking around, walking around, and it's like, oh my gosh, give me a break.
Well, Carhartt has been completely appropriated by, like, the fashion industry. Have you noticed this? Like, I walked into a museum this winter and it was like,
I used to wear Dickies.
Yeah, I think that's been appropriate to some extent too.
Dickies, like, I haven't seen those in a long time.
I bet you can get them at Urban Outfitters. Seriously.
Seriously?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We used to have to go to like the Maynard Five and Dime or something to get a pair of those.
Yeah, no, I walked into a museum this winter and I looked around and it was like 4 to 5 millennial or Gen Z white girls wearing the exact same Carhartt beanie.
It's weird what's come out. Like beautiful women in California, like very stylish, who were wearing white jeans that were like whitewashed with suspenders, a punk rock t-shirt, and like Oxblood Doc Martin boots. And I was like, are you a British skinhead from the 80s? That's like, you're wearing a uniform from like, what, are you in a band? It's like, no, it's just California stuff. They've never heard of The Exploited or any of these bands.
Okay, Chris, we get it. You you have a punk history.
Yeah.
People don't know about that.
They do, I think.
Do they?
I don't know. Anyways, I can identify weird stuff. Carhartts on models.
Didn't you have weird hair at one point? Didn't you dye your hair?
I had Liberty spikes, like the 1 foot long spikes. My poor mother and my poor father.
Are there pictures?
Yeah, there are. There's a few. I'll show you some. And I actually, Tucker threw some up. I don't know how the heck he got them. He threw some up on his Tucker Carlson Today show. He's asking about it, and they suddenly start appearing on the screen.
So, actually, this is a good point to focus on. I wanted to ask you about this when we were talking about Oz. You wrote a book called The Art of the Donald, which I think was one of the first arguments that really did a good job of just clarifying how Donald Trump, this billionaire, became a populist champion and a successful populist champion. Not just somebody who went out there and talked the populist game, but somebody who literally won the presidential nomination and then won the general election. And Oz seems to be doing exactly the opposite in that Trump was able to appeal to voters.
What do you call that grocery store? Wegfields or something?
Yeah, Wegners. Wegners. But like Trump, he gave helicopter rides at the Iowa State Fair. Like he didn't run from his money. He recognized that voters were
Trump's
like,
comfortable in his
that's
own skin.
Badass. Like we wish we could be billionaires. And Oz is literally going into a grocery store.
I'm poor like you.
Shopping for crudités and acting like this is, he's just like, like anyone else with the lack of awareness that nobody else in Pennsylvania is freaking shopping for crudités.
I don't even know what that was.
I don't know what it is. And yeah. I'm surprised you don't know what it is because you're so into the culinary arts. But like legitimately, no idea what crudités is.
Trump was someone who was really comfortable in his own skin and it didn't matter. He wasn't going to try and change outfits. I remember we'd be in New Hampshire and you'd see like a candidate would wear a suit to a middle class event. But an upper class event, he'd wear like a vest and roll up his sleeves because that's what they do. You know?
Youngin.
And then at the poor, like a poor person's event, he'd take off the vest and roll up the sleeves. And Donald Trump would walk into a biker bar in a Brioni suit with a trucker hat on.
Right.
Like didn't care no matter what. He said, and it was himself. People can sense that. People can tell if you're dressing up for them and or acting a certain way for them and don't actually care. And he was a very different candidate from a lot of the folks we have right now. But I will tell you this, there's some really, I'm excited about a lot of different things. One, no Liz Cheney. That's awesome. The end of the Cheney, the Bush, and the Clinton dynasties, all at the hands of Donald Trump.
All at the hands of Donald Trump.
Although I do also think that the Donald Trump did this, Wyoming voters who just have fealty to Donald Trump, is like super lazy analysis from D.C. and New York.
Let's talk about that. Keep going.
I mean, in D.C. and New York, reporters like they're eating their breakfast cereal and they see the reflection of Donald Trump in their milk and start to cry.
They see him in their crudités.
In their crudités. I mean, we're going to have to figure out what that is. Maybe we'll do a Federal's Radio cooking show or something on
I
that.
I think it's vegetables. I think it's cooked vegetables.
No wonder I don't know what it is.
Not cooked vegetables. I don't know. Who knows? I don't care. So I'm not eating vegetables.
Liz Cheney was so much worse than that. Liz Cheney was a neocon elitist, someone who years before this January 6th stuff, she tried to overthrow Kevin McCarthy, had Politico put a piece out on her where a congressman off the record said she is the next Margaret Thatcher. Imagine, like, D.C. is a place where someone will compliment their colleague with a really, like, over the top and say, hey, but you can't cite me. And the reporter will say, okay. Like, every part of that is gross and weird.
Who was it? Do we have a good idea?
No, there's too many congressmen. I have no idea.
Yeah, but I want to guess. Who would call Liz Cheney the next Margaret Thatcher?
And the whole thing was that she's going to bring the party back and she's going to change the party. And this was right
after Kinzinger. I bet you it was Kinzinger.
That actually makes sense. That's a great guess. We should ask him. Did you ever call Liz Cheney next Margaret Thatcher? Well, she's since blown past that. Liz Cheney compared herself. She said she was going to be president. She compared herself to Abraham Lincoln. And she compared her campaign to the Battle of Gettysburg and all the people who died there, which is just gruesome. But she tried to overthrow Kevin McCarthy with that. She tried to change the party back to a neocon thing. She never once tried to persuade. I can't think of a single moment where there was anything but elitist, haughty scorn in her eyes for those who disagreed with her. And listen, there can be a place for scorn. I've heaped it on people, but that's generally not what I'm trying to persuade them. Like this, and she never tried to actually push the Wyoming voter in a different direction. She just said, "You don't deserve me. You're scum. You're deplorable." And then she tried to make a principled stand out of giving the January 6th committee unfettered access to the private records of her own party, which had nothing to do with any kind of a riot, just so they could dig in and interrogate people without any – and played patsy to the Democrats without any defense lawyers. I was talking about
no
this –
No cross-examination, period.
I was talking about this with Jimmy Failla the other day. Do you know where we get the Western concept of a defense attorney for someone who represents the accused? From the Spanish Inquisition. Somebody in the Spanish Inquisition was like, well, if we're going to accuse people of being, like, satanic, we should probably have someone defend them, right? this is a medieval church court. And that's where we got it from. And the J6 committee is like, we don't need that. We don't need that stuff.
Yeah, right.
So
no.
Less fair than the Spanish Inquisition.
But
take it to the bank.
But Liz Cheney would probably say more serious than the Spanish Inquisition.
The Spanish Inquisition, kind of a defender. We can talk about that in another podcast.
I'd rather not.
Not always wrong.
Well, so yeah, I actually want to keep on this point because I'm trying to find a tweet that I think was...
A lot of witches.
Claire.
I walked in, I said, wow, it's a lot of witches.
That is the Shane Gillis bit about Trump. If you want to impersonate Trump, you just walk into a room and you say, wow, it's a lot of witches.
I walked in and then talk about yourself doing it.
Yeah. So there was this tweet from a journalist, Kimberly Ross, who said a lot of people, I think like a conservative-ish journalist, a lot of people will say a lot of things about Liz Cheney today. Regardless of your feelings about the January 6th committee, the stranglehold Trump still has on the GOP is unacceptable and unsustainable. The chapter should close, but I doubt it will anytime soon. And then I responded, basically what you were saying, Chris, it's a mistake to really see that opposition to Cheney as more of a statement on Trump than a statement on the establishment that hates Trump. So that is to say, people are motivated to go pull the lever for Donald Trump, not because in every case they just love Donald Trump. They're one of the, you know, MAGA hat wearing people. It's because they recognize that Liz Cheney is a part of this establishment that has hurt the country.
You can't hit your voters. It's like Liz Cheney shooting Liz Cheney and then turning the camera and saying Trump did this. And all the reporters just agree with her, like, oh my gosh, Trump did this.
Liz Cheney said something to the effect the other day of how you know, she could have won her re-election if she had just not come out in the January 6th situation. Like, she could have just kept her mouth closed and won re-election. It's like, okay, is that perhaps true? Yes, but that's not proof that people are just reacting to your opposition to Trump. They're reacting to what your opposition to Trump symbolizes and the nature and character of your opposition to Trump, which became sanctimonious and haughty, as you said, Chris. And that is a much bigger part of the equation.
I love the Tucker question. How did she make an average of $6 million a year while in Congress? yeah. for 7 years. He's just asking questions. Mm-hmm. Just asking questions. But she's so far removed, and I think Tucker was right. I look forward to seeing her fully endowed chair at AEI and her column at National Review, and see where else she starts to go.
She's more of a bulwark person these days.
Yeah, maybe.
So, Chris, back on...
Back to that Twitter fight you were talking about, the back and forth. I really like the back and forth between Robbie Suave and Molly Hemingway.
Oh, it was interesting.
Robbie was like, wow, I really wish that she'd gone down for all these neoconservative wars as opposed to just opposition to Donald Trump and his cult of personality. And Molly was like, her opposition to Donald Trump is based on her love of neoconservative wars and his enemy and his antipathy for them, or his being against those things. So it's just, there are so many folks who are just missing what was actually at stake here, because everywhere they look, they see Donald Trump and they're frightened.
Yes, and this is actually...
And it's easy. It's too easy.
This is really worth pausing on. This was a line that was trotted out constantly during the January 6th hearings, which was that these witnesses have nothing to gain and everything to lose from speaking out against Donald Trump. They're lifelong Republicans. And it's like easy to forget that when Liz Cheney was reacting in the aftermath of January 6th, there was this idea, very strong idea in Washington, D.C., that Trump was done, that everyone can wash their hands of Trump and move on. You see that in the statements issued immediately after January 6th. And I'm not saying people, especially those people who were in the Capitol, were overreacting or anything, but you could feel the sigh of relief from everyone in D.C., Republicans in D.C.
Mitch McConnell got so ahead of his skis. He gave a speech denouncing Trump.
Exactly.
And Mitch McConnell usually, if he hates you, you'll feel it, but she's not going to say it.
Yeah. And so this was the atmosphere after January 6th. And some Republicans, you know, really painted themselves into that corner and really thought that this was it, that Donald Trump is done. And some of them still think that. Like, I guarantee you, Liz Cheney thinks
there's
that.
There's no shortage of delusionally self-important people who think that they're principled, but really they're just jerks.
Well, you know what's interesting also is that if the sort of Never Trump right and the people who were privately Never Trump during the Trump administration, like Liz Cheney, who was voting, her voting record was pretty much in lockstep with the Trump wing of the Republican Party, although obviously on foreign policy, that is a completely different question. And had she actually really been pressed on populist ideas with a second term, that is a completely different question, too. But somebody who was outwardly friendly to Trump, privately, certainly not friendly to Trump, the reason she made that calculation, the reason that calculation changed for her is not because she thought January 6th that Donald Trump had committed some grave offense. She may have convinced herself that that was the reason, but the real reason she changed her tune is because she thought that Donald Trump's political fortunes had faded.
It was safe for the neocons to slither out again.
Exactly.
Not
safe. It was both safe and beneficial.
Yeah.
There was an advantage to doing it.
I remember thinking about what's going to happen during this election, talking to some friends who are on the populist right and saying, what's going to happen if Donald Trump loses? What's the plan? And I was like, well, If Donald Trump loses this election, this is before the election, before January 6th, or any of that crap, then the plan is probably there's going to be a serious thirst for vengeance from the neoconservative establishment Republican Party. Say, look what you've done. You've led us here. How dare you? And they're going to come in with knives. And I assume an immediate defensive posture. Basically build a crusader castle and surround it with the heads of your enemies. And I was shocked at how feeble the response was. It was just a bunch of Liz Cheney's and Kinzinger's, like, limp-wristed slapping at people and just getting picked off one by one. Because the reality was, and I wrote about this for the Federalist when Liz Cheney first came out, is like, we're going to change the party. By the time Donald Trump left office, more than half of Republican congressmen and senators had been elected 2016 or later.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
like mm-hmm. the party was, it was so far removed from the party of George W. Bush, so far gone. The voters had moved on. The donors were skeptical. I mean, the big neocon donors are either quiet or are passing away. It's a it's a changed party, and there's nothing. And their counterattack, which I was expecting to be kind of ferocious, was actually just super. It's kind of funny in some ways.
And you know, but that brings us back, I think, to this midterm cycle in an interesting context, because there may be, I don't know how this is all going to shake out, but I think there easily could be overreactions. Let's say it doesn't go as well as Republicans hope it will for the GOP. There may easily be overreactions saying, you know, the idiot MAGA wing of the party gave us Herschel Walker and lost a state like Georgia. You know, it's time for us to seize control back of the party. But what this looks like, if we can sort of take a breath and 30,000 foot view, it looks like a short-term problem in this long-term picture of adjustment, where you still have the halls of power here in Washington, D.C., the RNC, McConnell's office, the McConnell wing of the Republican
RNC
establishment.
RNC is not bad.
No, they're not. But you know what I'm talking about. There's still people in those places who are way more friendly to, say, McConnell. At America Rising, I think someone was just let go. I think one of the top people at America Rising, which is a kind of a dark money group that is here in D.C., was just had to leave because he was working for Cheney. And so that's in and of itself an interesting picture, right? That you have a group like America Rising, which I think is a Paul Singer group, that was always, you know, not super populist, but is now letting go of somebody because working for Liz Cheney is a political liability.
Yeah, like 9 months after they had vax mandates, if I recall correctly.
I don't remember, but like that's an interesting, right? Like, so what we're seeing here is the Republican Party.
Now these people
are
becoming liabilities.
Well, yeah, and so, and I think, you know, you'll probably have a place where J.D. Vance is going to win. Blake Masters will definitely have a close race no matter what.
I'm bullish on that.
Yeah, I am too. We'll see. But then you're going to have the Ozzes and you're going to have the Herschel Walkers.
Who knows? I mean, I don't think the Oz is going to win, but that doesn't mean he couldn't.
No, not at all. I don't think.
Actually, I haven't looked at polling. As I told you, my mind has been entirely on culture war.
Yeah.
And also vacationing
too.
In Ocean City.
Yeah. Well, so Oz is actually down like a lot.
A lot?
In
okay.
the RCB average.
I haven't even looked at it.
We're around 10 points, 8 to 10 down on average, which is where I think that's where I saw the RCP average. We're talking around 8 to 10. And Ron Johnson, there was just this shock poll, out of Marquette University, where Tony Evers and the Republican nominee for governor are running in a much closer race than Ron Johnson and Mandela Barnes. And Johnson was down by, I think, like 8. And those Marquette polls can be outliers sometimes, so I'm not going to read too much into it at the moment. But there's something interesting about Ron Johnson, and he was on the podcast a few months ago. To me, that he's a much stronger candidate than the Republican establishment thinks. You'll remember, Chris, when McConnell and maybe the Koch brothers sort of left him for dead back in, what was it, 2016, just assuming he was going to lose to Russ Feingold. Remember this? Mm-hmm. And he returned to Congress, I think, a changed man, kind of with his eyes, you know, even
Ron
more.
John?
Yeah.
He's been doing great work. He's kicked off of YouTube like once a week.
I think that's a huge advantage for him. And I mean, politically, I mean that.
He's serious. I didn't quite realize it when he was first in the first around, that just how good he was on so many issues.
Well, he was sort of a run-of-the-mill Tea Party guy, elected in 2010, came in, and like a run-of-the-mill, normal boomer conservative businessman who was talking about taxes and Obamacare and all of that. And
that was out there like rattling on vaccine mandates,
yeah,
and fighting the good fight. I love it.
Well, but this is what I'm saying. I think that's a huge advantage for him, because this gets to the art of the Donald question, and that's why I wanted to ask you about it, because it's a question of authenticity. And so if you have a Dr. Oz who's out there with sleeves rolled up in a grocery store pretending he's upset about inflation when he's really not upset about inflation because he can afford it, versus a Ron Johnson who really has nothing to gain, I mean that in an actual sense this time, by railing. Even being like out further than most, like Trump Republicans are comfortable talking about vaccines, talking about the FBI, talking about all of this stuff. While it may not be politically popular in the state, it might not be that every swing voter finds that attractive, because a lot of them probably don't. They believe what you're saying. They believe that you believe what you're saying. They believe that you're honest. They believe that you're an authentic person. That gets people to vote.
And at the end of the day, it's not a general election. I mean, there's no president on the ballot.
A bad economy, not a general election. Yeah.
So, I mean, like those people out there
and
who
Dems
are like,
are
you
crazy?
Know, I'm not really. Yeah, the Dems are crazy. Like if you're just a run-of-the-mill independent voter, typically you're not super enthused about this. Like a traffic jam or an extra meeting or something is going to stop you from voting, because who cares? So it's not like people who just – it's not like people are just going to go out there and pull the handle because somebody did a mean tweet.
Yeah.
They just won't vote if they don't care like that. So it's a benefit to candidates like Ron Johnson, and that's what I think.
No, totally. And to your point, I just saw before we started recording an ad about Johnson's opponent, Mandela Barnes, that was tying him to the squad. And, you know, that's Mark Kelly, John Fetterman, these attacks are coming. And that's why we're doing this little preview here in August, because that's what people are likely going to see in September and October, is as the money pours into those races, those types of attacks, taking these, you know, supposedly really great Dem candidates. I do think Fetterman is a good candidate that in terms of like Democrats' electability.
Well, he is. I guess he's now pursuing the Biden strategy, which is don't go out in public and don't give speeches.
He's recovering from a stroke.
Yeah. Was Biden not?
What else are you going to say? Okay. Do you want to talk about Greta Thunberg?
I'm just saying, not a statesman. A little too hyper-focused on one issue for the rest of her life.
What else could you? It's not the airing
of grievances.
No, it's really not. And that's why we haven't touched on the 30 Years War yet. But don't you dare. Well, Chris, as we wrap up, I want to touch on one point that you brought up. You were talking about how, I mean, we're talking about, in terms of Chris, we're talking about a guy who was an editor of a pretty robust daily news publication, the Daily Caller, for years. And you were consuming the TikTok and the horse race news at an incredible clip and volume, just because you had to.
Every day, all day.
Yeah, you could ask
Reading
Chris.
Tens of thousands, like thousands, hundreds of pages every single day, and not a single book.
Right, right, right. And you could ask Chris about, you know, what's happening in Indiana's first district, and he'd be able to tell you what the race looked like. Maybe, I don't know. But just that is to say, you were covering politics a lot more closely. But I think your point about how you're much more focused and interested in the culture war now is an important one, because in the political horse race analysis of a midterm cycle and then a presidential cycle, you know, a lot of this stuff ends up getting, I think, papered over unhelpfully. So, like, in 2016, or maybe in 2012, that's a much better example. In 2012, we're talking about Mitt Romney's record at Bain Capital, and Republicans are so focused on getting him elected, they don't say, oh, wait a second, private equity. Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
Private equity is corrupt.
The blind partisan devotion to stupid and terrible candidates was a disaster. The fact that the Tea Party wasn't able to deliver on any of its core promises. It's just, you watch a couple of these cycles and you just start to notice, like, all right, I can tell now when someone's a candidate for serious change that's actually going to make a difference. And I can tell when this is just the same old GOP business where Mitch McConnell yells Tea Party or waves a musket, or Mitch McConnell yells MAGA. Well, Mitch McConnell does whatever Mitch McConnell wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to stay. I know some people get really addicted to it and are just like, they love the politics. But after a couple election cycles, I'm just sitting here looking at it like, all right, there seems to be bigger issues than just what's going on. I mean, the problems that our country faces aren't going to be fixed by a Republican majority in the House and a tie in the Senate with a Democratic president. They're not going to be fixed by a Republican majority in the House, Senate, and in the White House, as we've seen the last two times we've had those things. So I have been a little focused on different issues. And surprisingly, it's kind of like refreshing to be hyper-focused on how this country is going to hell as opposed to electoral politics. It feels like it's like a lighter subject.
Somehow. Yeah. Well, so I interviewed on the podcast Tristan Harris recently, who was heavily featured in The Social Dilemma. That's super, super popular. Netflix documentary about big tech and social media's addictiveness and the actual like way that they run like slot machines. And in that conversation, it was a really interesting one because when you are on that bigger picture 30,000 foot level, you realize exactly what you just said. Like these problems, the problems of the country, they are not going to be solved by Republicans in Congress. They're not going to be solved by Democrats in Congress. They can do stuff to help get us in the right direction.
They sure can.
They can break up big tech and bring competition in a way that's more responsive to things consumers want, which is less addictiveness, which is, you know, limits on porn, which is all of those things. They can help. But this is so much deeper. You know, I'm glad that we're at the Federalist, where that's very clear to everyone.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, I got to write this week about the rosaries.
You did. It was a lovely piece. Can you just say the headline of it? Because I when I saw the headline come in, I was like, I'm not Catholic, but I was just galvanized.
It was the Atlantic wrote a piece calling the rosaries extremist and radical and a weapon. And I said, you're right.
No, really.
But not in the way you think you are.
It's not a statement on the people you're trying to smear. It's a statement on you that the rosary is indeed radical and a weapon at this point.
It gets to the root of exactly what we believe. And when you're in a society that's completely steeped in sin and lies, just as we've always been, just as we were 800 years ago when the rosary first started being prayed and are today, the rosary stands out as extreme. And the rosary is your weapon against evil. And if you're a liberal,
yes,
and you see a combination of masculinity, religion, demonic forces. Now, masculinity was one aspect of the rosary. They were talking about the rosary itself as a Marian prayer. Yes. But you see all these different things come together. You just say alarm bells start going off, and you combine that with a couple like internet memes, like the rosary Deus Vult stuff, and you just start a liberal panic.
Yeah.
I mean, you might as well be a cartoon frog. They're going to freak out so much. So
you should Photoshop the frog with the rosary.
Do you see the rosaries with the chainsaw sword
attachment? The chainsaw
this is
bayonet.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But anyways, check it out at thefederalist.com. And guess what? Tomorrow, if you want to join, we're going to be doing a podcast with John Daniel Davidson and John Daniel Davidson's brother.
Whoa.
It's like the Cool Kids Club.
Joel?
Yeah.
All right. But really?
Yeah, about Alaskan politics.
Oh, okay.
How the elections work.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, tune in.
Good. Good to know. Oh, wait, you did run this by me earlier this week.
You know, we're still on air.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's great. That's great. Yeah, that's good. I should add that to my calendar. Well, Christopher Bedford, senior editor at The Federalist, thank you so much for stopping by.
It's been mostly good.
50%. Well, we'll be back with another edition of The Federalist Radio Hour soon. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Reason, and then it faded away.